A very good evening to you all. It's good to see the room packed. My name's Tony Travers from the Government Department and the Institute of Public Affairs here at the LSE. And we're delighted this evening to be hosting a public lecture by Ruth Davidson, who is the leader of the Scottish Conservative and Unionist Party. And I'll say just a couple of more words about Ruth in a moment. There is a hashtag here, #LSE Davidson.
Yes.
So don't forget that. Right, now, as I said, Ruth Davidson is leader of the Scottish Conservative and Unionist Party. Worth remembering that. There's lots of history tangled up in that word. And, of course, the Conservative Party in Scotland, Conservative and Unionist Party in Scotland, is today the second largest grouping in the Scottish Parliament. Ruth's been leader of the party since 2011 and is member of the Scottish Parliament for Edinburgh Central. After graduating, she worked as a BBC journalist and as a signaller in the Territorial Army. Now, she campaigned for Scotland to remain within the United Kingdom, thus the Union, in 2014, and more recently for the UK to remain within the EU in 2016. So it's sort of one all, really, for you, isn't it? I think it's fair to say that Ruth Davidson is one of the best-known and indeed liked politicians in UK public life and is seen as bringing a degree of common sense and approachability to the complex world of modern British politics. Under her leadership, the Conservatives in Scotland have prospered mightily to the point where a Conservative government in Edinburgh, and it's worth remembering that it seems hard for many people to believe this, the Conservative Party used to win more than half the seats in the UK Parliament in Scotland in the 1950s and held many more councils than it did today. So nothing, as they say, is forever. And now, of course, we're in the position where it's conceivable, in a way, and I wrote here, it would have been inconceivable a decade ago, but others, perhaps even 5 years, even 2 years ago, it would have been inconceivable that the Conservatives could be in contention in Edinburgh to become the largest party, even the government, at Holyrood. So this evening, Ruth is going to talk about a renewed case for the union. Ladies and gentlemen, Ruth Davidson.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Can I thank Tony for those kind words of introduction? It is a real honour, actually, for me to be speaking at the LSE this evening, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity. I'm also thoroughly delighted by the hashtag. I think we can rock it tonight, so please use it. Firstly, please let me say how calm and pleasant you all look as an audience compared to others I've had to face in London in recent times. I'm thinking particularly about the bear pit, which was Wembley last June. 2 days before the referendum vote itself, 6,500 screaming people in the audience, all wondering who the hell this small, shouty Scottish woman was. And as much as I enjoyed getting to know both Sadiq Khan and Francis O'Grady and working with them at that event, I think as a stadium gig goes, it's not something that I fancy repeating, and I think that's at least one thing that I do have in common with Boris Johnson. So in this slightly more comfortable, slightly more civilised atmosphere this evening, I'd like to take this opportunity instead to turn down the volume from last year's shout-a-thon. Today I want to try and calmly and rationally assess where we stand following that Brexit vote last June, and to look at how we as one United Kingdom should now progress from last year's turmoil and meet the undoubted challenges that face us as we do so. And if you'll forgive me, I'd also like to focus on the very specific set of circumstances that we face in Scotland as well. Only now, emerging from the divisions of the independence referendum campaign in 2014, hit sideways by the referendum decision of 2016, Scotland is having to face up to the grim possibility of, you guessed it, demand for yet another referendum to clear it all up. You might not realise this from looking at me, but I'm actually only 21. I just feel 104. And I do know how all of this can look from the outside. People look at Scotland and they see the seemingly endless turmoil there and think that separation is somehow inevitable. It's especially easy to do when a significant cohort of SNP politicians use the opportunity to say so every time they're on the television. But my central argument this evening will be that despite the uncertainty, the insecurity and the challenges, the case for the union, for our union, remains strong, if not stronger, than it ever was. We just have to ensure that we make the right case for an outward-looking Britain, one that provides us with all of the security, the opportunity and the stability that we crave. So about 7 and a bit months on from that night at Wembley, where do we stand? In some ways, I sort of feel like the man from Tipperary asking for directions. As someone who campaigned to stay part of the European Union, it's only stating the obvious to say that as we set out on our journey, I wouldn't necessarily have started from here. But over the last 7 months, politicians like me have had to make a decision and we've had to make a choice. Either to deny the message that we received from people across the United Kingdom last year, or to accept the result and to put in the work and to endeavour to make the best of it. I've said this many times before and I'll repeat it tonight. Had the result of the Scottish referendum gone against my side in 2014, I wouldn't have denied the vote or demanded an immediate rerun. So in exactly the same way, people recognise that Brexit was voted for and is happening. And I can either deny it or buckle down and make it work. And I choose to try to make it work. As the Prime Minister has made clear, this won't be easy. One thing that I predict with 100% certainty is that when our negotiations begin in earnest soon, we will be met with numerous voices across Europe telling us that our demands cannot be met. That's how negotiations work. So prepare for 18 months of being told no before the final few months where agreements are reached. And of course, many in the EU27 will be keen to demonstrate that there is a penalty that comes with leaving the European Union in order to act as a warning to others. At the same time, it is against the interests of all countries in Europe, either inside or outside the EU, to damage relations or to block free trade. What is now key, I believe, is that we turn down the temperature and we focus on how to build this new relationship of respect, of shared interest and of mutual regard. To turn away from the jingoism of some in UKIP who still seem to find this one sort of big joke, and to recognise the genuine hurt and confusion that our decision has caused many in Europe, for whom the EU has always been an emotional project as well as a practical one. All the better to convince our European partners that we want to remain a nation still fully engaged in the continent. And there is still a belief across the continent, I fear, that people in the UK voted to leave en masse out of xenophobia, that we are part of a continent-wide insurrection that sets a course back to the 30s. And I hope that that view is now changing. And I believe it is changing. And as we begin to set the clear strategic direction for how we want our country to progress in the coming years, a direction which is neither left-wing vision nor a right-wing one, not a party political plan at all. Rather, it is about the posture that we adopt as a country, no matter which government happens to be in charge at any single time. And in her speech at Lancaster House a few weeks ago, I believe the Prime Minister provided us with that direction very clearly, respecting the outcome of the referendum, but at the same time recognising that leaving the EU does not mean isolationism or economic nationalism, but a new type of relationship with Europe and with the world. With, at its heart, a determination to secure a new free trade agreement between the EU and the UK, and a commitment to strike new trade deals with other nations around the world too. And I repeat my words from earlier, anybody who thinks that delivering these things will be easy is mistaken. Indeed, what is striking about the Prime Minister's proposals is their ambition and scope. But for those of us who campaign to remain in the EU for reasons of trade, and for the many, many leavers who also back Brexit to go global. This very ambition and this desire to remain open to the world is reassuring, and it is necessary. We do not have to look very far right now to see a very different form of economic theory being proposed across the globe, one that seeks to provide easy answers to deep problems, one which lays the blame for legitimate anger and resentment at the door of the usual scapegoats, which says that free trade and engagement with the world, despite having lifted countless millions out of poverty in the last 40 years, is now somehow the cause of society's decay. Well, every crisis is an opportunity. And I believe that if we keep to the course set by the Prime Minister last month, there is an opportunity for us to demonstrate how a nation can provide more security and more support to its citizens by doing so. To show that an open attitude to the world is actually beneficial to us here at home. And to show that by strengthening institutions such as NATO, such as the UN, that a global order adds to our own peace of mind. To demonstrate that international cooperation, whether through aid giving or through worldwide campaigning, doesn't just help people on the far corner of the globe, but also adds to our security and our prosperity too. And in many ways, that is the more difficult path. At a time of uncertainty, at a time of economic populism, a UKIP-style retreat to a happier, non-existent path would be a much easier course. But if we are, as a country, to come back together again, if we are to heal the divisions between Remain and Leave, then I don't see another way forward. It is the only path to take. For good or ill, we have made our decision. And now I believe we should, as a country, adopt the attitude of the entrepreneur, of the man or woman who surveys the landscape around them and seeks to make the most of it. And who knows, setting an example post-Brexit as a free trade, open-facing country might just persuade some of our friends with whom we have a special relationship that their own path is the wrong way to go. Though, of course, I name no names. So had I been a member of the Houses of Parliament last week, I would have voted for Article 50 to have been triggered. Not because I've changed my mind about Brexit, but because we said we'd take this decision as a whole UK. We would ask the people to choose, and then we would get on and we would deliver. We should now seek to begin negotiations as expeditiously as we can to provide security and stability as best we can. Because above all, people have had enough of uncertainty. And there is nowhere in the United Kingdom where that applies more right now than in Scotland. As I alluded to earlier, the referendum scrap last year was not our first adventure into the happy world of referenda contests, nor was it our first encounter with much of the language. The term Project Fear was used by nationalists to dismiss any hard questions about what independence might mean, long before it was adopted by Leave to be similarly dismissive. By the middle of last year, I can assure you that the joke for us in Scotland was wearing a little bit thin, because it is now nearly 10 years since the SNP published their very first white paper on Scottish independence, described back then as a national conversation. And please let me assure you, most of us are thoroughly talked out. The arguments have been heard, they've been heard easily 20 times over, and all that's left are the minor issues that the SNP still haven't cleared up, such as what currency would an independent Scotland use? How would it fill an annual £15 billion deficit? Why is trade with our nearest neighbour, the United Kingdom, why would that be improved as a result of all of this? And also the most basic question of all, why do the nationalists think that Scotland leaving the wider union of the EU, our second biggest trading partner, is so damaging that the only answer is to then leave the wider union of the UK, which is our biggest partner and worth more than four times more? Why is the answer to stubbing your toe amputating your foot? And yet, despite all of this, the nationalist bandwagon rolls on. Nicola Sturgeon announced the morning after the Brexit result, indeed before some votes had even been counted, that she had already instructed officials to draw up legislation for another referendum bill for the Scottish Parliament. And ever since, the drumbeat for Indie Ref 2 has grown ever louder. Now, whenever I come and I speak to a London audience, I feel it is necessary sometimes to set out some facts about all of this, because the SNP is brilliant at making it seem as if they and only they speak for Scotland. And for those of you who have other things on your mind most of the time, it's quite understandable, therefore, that you assume this to be the case. So when you hear Alex Salmond declaring that independence is inevitable and that the people of Scotland are champing at the bit to leave the UK, I get that it can sound plausible. However, if I may, even in a post-fact world, let me give you a couple of facts. Despite the SNP's best efforts, support for a referendum on independence in response to Brexit is now falling and not rising. Indeed, one poll recently put support at just 27%, down from 43% immediately after the EU vote. And secondly, support for independence itself is flatlining. It is absolutely true to say that since Brexit, some people appear to have moved from no to yes. However, it is equally true to say that since Brexit, others have moved from yes to no. Broadly speaking, they have cancelled each other out. We voted 55-45 in 2014, a split that has proved remarkably stubborn. Now, I am not complacent one bit about the state of the Union post-Brexit. The SNP is a formidable political operation which I suspect has learned from the tactics of the Leave campaign last year and is itching to get its own campaign bus into gear. So my view is that the case for the Union must be made afresh, and we have to persuade people once again that our own Union of Nations still works for us. And there is something of a Brexit paradox here. Because while Brexit has provided the means for Nicola Sturgeon to crank up her independence campaign once again, it has also made that case weaker and more illogical than ever. So let me go back to trade. The SNP's case in 2014 was constructed around what might now be called soft independence. Scotland would be a sovereign country, the SNP declared, but at the same time it would keep the pound and, like the rest of the UK, remain within the European Union. It was independence, but claimed the SNP, with Scotland still part of two wider unions. It was all bogus, of course, but self-evidently, even that bogus case no longer stands. Now the SNP says that an independent Scotland would still seek membership of the European Union, which now means if it ever happened, the border at Berwick would become a frontier of the European Union. The SNP has also floated the idea that rather than joining the European Union itself, it could simply ask to take part in the EEA. And this way, the theory goes, it could still keep a toe in both the UK and Europe. But even if this arrangement could pass muster in the court of public opinion, we must go back on our word and rerun the independence poll because Britain left the EU, but we're not arguing for Scotland to be an EU member. Even if that doublethink could pass, frankly, the same problems would still apply. If you take one of Scotland's most important sectors in farming, fully 85% of Scotland's agri-products which leave Scotland go to the rest of the UK. We are reliant on trade with the rest of the UK to an enormous degree. But even as members of the First Minister's own Standing Council of European Experts have admitted, if Scotland was in the European single market with the rest of the UK outside, there would inevitably be one set of regulations in England and another in Scotland. Even if no tariffs applied, it would still damage trade, as we know non-tariff barriers are disruptive. I cannot put it better than the Scottish Government's own expert body, Scottish Trade International. 2 weeks ago, its director put it like this. Why would we try to make it more difficult to trade with our largest trading partner or reduce the amount of trade that we do with the rest of the UK? And he added, whatever circumstances play out, it will be paramount that we protect free trade on the open market with the rest of the UK. Because as we learned only last month in official Scottish Government statistics, trade with the UK internal market is worth four times to Scotland that of trade with the EU. And the logic is therefore clear. If everyone in Scotland agrees that free trade with Europe is important, and we do, it is literally impossible to deny that trade with the UK matters four times as much. I have, to be fair, seen some SNP figures, face scrunched up, jaws clenched, fists pumping, admit just as much in recent weeks as their temple vein throbbed. But rather than accept the logic of this fact, to therefore protect our own union first and foremost, the same old nationalist contortions were still being applied. Indeed, their actual serious response to the figures showing how much extra we trade with the UK than the Europe was to point out that while this may be the case, Europe has more people in it than the UK. Now, to be fair, this is true. And I accept it. I accept it as fact. And that might be a fantastic case to make for trade if you're in Denmark or if you're in Switzerland or if you're in Slovakia. But if you're in Scotland and you're already part of a highly integrated economic unit called the United Kingdom, which buys most of your goods and services, and if you're separated from Europe by a few dozen miles of water, it is a fact which is somewhat missing the point. So given the flaws of this argument, you won't be surprised to learn that the SNP has no intention of using economics to make the case for independence. Instead, it is already cranking up the grievance machine in an attempt to push people towards the exit door. And as I suggested before, I do not doubt the power of such campaigns, and Brexit has provided the SNP with plenty of ammunition. But I do believe that the SNP will struggle to succeed. And that's for one key reason. Because for all they enjoy the status of plucky outsiders at Westminster, the SNP is no longer the insurgent in Scottish politics. For 10 years, they have been the government. And after a decade of using that position to push their constitutional agenda, there is no question in my mind that people elected them last year on the condition that they stopped banging on about independence and instead focused on the day job. Partly, this is due to the increased power that they now hold. As of April of this year, it will be the SNP that sets tax rates in Scotland, not Westminster. And once a government begins to dig deep into your wallet, I'll wager that people will take a more active interest in how it's managing our money. But partly, it's also due to the growing concern over our own public fabric. As in England, concerns over the NHS are growing. A failure to keep pace with demographic pressure, plus a growing recruitment crisis, requires government attention urgently. And more than down south, there is now growing discontent with the condition of Scotland's education system. Only last week, we had a further reminder of the state that we're in. A report by the Sutton Trust found that the education system is failing our most able pupils, particularly those from poorer backgrounds. The findings in science teaching, in particular, were deeply worrying. Under the SNP, the performance of able pupils has declined, equivalent to an entire year of schooling. And at a time when we know that expertise in STEM subjects are all the more vital, it is a record that requires emergency government action. And I have welcomed some of the plans the SNP have outlined in this regard. Moves to push more funding direct to head teachers, to give schools more autonomy, to provide school-by-school data on performance. All of that is correct, if after 10 years of SNP government, massively overdue. But it does pose a dilemma for the SNP. When she won her election as First Minister last year, Nicola Sturgeon promised that education would be her priority. Indeed, in response to me last week in Parliament, she declared she remained absolutely focused on making sure that we take the action that will deliver further improvements. And I welcome that commitment from the First Minister. I applaud her for saying that education will be her priority. And she is absolutely right to say that her focus should be to ensure real and lasting improvements to our education system. But my point is this. We have just lived through 10 years of an SNP government where, by their own admission, they have been asleep at the wheel on education, where constitutional division has taken precedence over education reform. Now we're told that that is changing. Yet at the same time, the threat of a second referendum is once again being revived. So the questions that people will ask are these. If the First Minister now says she wants an absolute focus on education, why is she considering another referendum campaign which will inevitably distract her from that goal? How can education be the priority for her if she plunges us back into another all-consuming fight over Scotland's place in the UK? And if she spends the next 2 years fighting over a second referendum, how will her government have the time to deliver the changes in education that she says she wants? In many ways, the reforms that the SNP has outlined will challenge some long-held orthodoxies in Scotland. And we know from experience elsewhere in the world that such reforms only really work with a committed and focused government at the centre, driving that change forward. So I believe that the First Minister now faces a choice. Either focus on her own priority and ensure our schools are turned around, or to push ahead with a second referendum, which will only distract her from that goal. She says she wants a second referendum, and I say Scotland's children won't get a second chance. She either focuses on her own stated priority, or she betrays that pledge in favour of the SNP's constitutional obsession. She really can't have it both ways. And simply put, I don't think that the majority of people in Scotland will tolerate the SNP setting all of these things aside over the coming 2 years to refight a campaign on independence. Not when, as our elected government, we want it to actually focus on running the country for once. So my focus as leader of the opposition in Scotland is to hold the SNP to account in getting on with that job. That's why we more than doubled our number of MSPs last year, because people of all political stripes want someone to do that job after a period where it felt like the SNP could get away with anything. To have someone who will stand up against yet more uncertainty and division and say no to another referendum. And that is why, against their own expectations, all their attempts to weaponise Brexit to boost support for independence have simply not worked. Incidentally, this is why I would also caution Labour against their new wheeze in Scotland to open up the debate once more by proposing a new constitutional convention of the entire UK with a new Act of Union to give the 1707 one a bit of a refresh. The one thing that I've learned over the last few years, beware of Labour politicians with a plan to fix the Union. But I want to say this too. Those of us who hold our United Kingdom dear and who want to keep it together should not dismiss the challenge that the SNP poses, no matter how weak the case for independence may seem. And nor should we belittle it, because we should never forget that in 2014, 1.6 million people in Scotland voted to leave the United Kingdom. And as I said before last year's election, we must now seek to listen to their concerns, their needs, their aspirations, and convince them that the UK is a country that they want to be part of. Returning more power to our nations and regions under this Conservative government has, I believe, helped to do this. At its best, devolution to Wales, to London and elsewhere has reinvigorated the debate in parts of Britain and ensured that they can talk back to central governments in a way that is only healthy and mature. But in order to really address people's dissatisfaction, I believe we also need to demonstrate that we have a guiding sense of purpose, and my own preference would be for us to make that case as we leave the EU. As we leave, however, there is no reason we cannot make it. As a country that pushes at our boundaries instead of building walls, as a country that expounds the virtues of free trade and solidarity with our allies and neighbours, knowing that this is the way to ease poverty, to build a more just world, and to make us here at home safer and more secure. As a country that seeks to balance people's hunger for self-determination in a fast-changing world, with the knowledge that we serve nobody by blocking that world from our door. Ladies and gentlemen, I lost the case for one union last year, and I have no intention of losing another. But if we are to win the argument, we must step up and demonstrate that our own union is a living, breathing being which can change when required, which is responsive to people's needs, which is open to the world around us. I remain confident that the UK is that country. We just need to show it. Thank you. Thank you.
Very good. Now we've got some time for questions, debate, disagreement, whatever you like. I'm going to start though with one or two of my own questions. Forgive me, audience. Just beginning with the remark about beware the Labour Party bearing constitutional gifts, if I can put it that way. I mean, clearly the UK has become a quasi-federal country. It's partly still like a unitary state, but it's also now has elements of a federal state, and certainly with the tax-raising powers that Scotland and soon Wales, Scotland has and Wales will have. And with that in mind, how are we to manage the inevitable disagreements that will come up? We don't have a constitutional court. We don't actually have a constitutional law. Or do we? Are we all right just muddling along as the Brits always have, or the UK always has?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of things in there. When you talk about kind of, or I spoke about Labour, I think we shouldn't forget that when devolution was established in 1999, I think it was John Reid that said that having a Scottish Parliament in Edinburgh would, quote-unquote, shoot the nationalist fox. Well, John, how's that working out for you? You know, occasionally you kind of doff your cap to your opponents when they come out with something that you kind of wish you'd thought of yourself. When the current Scottish Labour Party decided that their response to renewed calls from the SNP to sort of set aside the idea that the referendum was once in a generation, you know, that they wanted to run it again, that they were going to try and agitate for it, their response was to set up a pan-UK constitutional convention. The SNP response from their press office was that as the last mushroom cloud rises after the world is destroyed, the Labour Party will still be calling for a constitutional convention. And that was the way in which they were dismissed. So it's a trope that they've used before. And like I say, occasionally you do have to acknowledge when your opponents have kind of hit something on the head. But I think in terms of your wider question about how does the UK manage, well, I think that we don't take templates from anyone else. We are, as you say, a wonderfully messy nation. We're the only nation state in the world that is itself comprised of four nations. We're the only places that have devolved legislatures in the asymmetric way that they are devolved here. So, yes, there is an element of muddle in the way that we get through things, and there always has been. And while I don't say that we shouldn't codify things, that I don't say we shouldn't have as many structures and transparent bodies that we can make sure that we can untangle some of our tangles from. I don't think either should we be afraid sometimes of things being a bit muddled and sometimes being a bit messy.
Would you see the Supreme Court as having any role in this, or just it too would feel its way along? If there was a serious disagreement between the UK government in London and the Scottish government over an issue, a big issue of principle.
Well, we just saw them. There was a result that came out last month.
True.
And you had the Advocate General for the UK government going up against the the Scottish parliamentary equivalent, James Wolfe and Richard Keane, going at it in the Supreme Court, and the court did what courts do and should do, which is judge something on a case-by-case basis. That's what courts are for. They judge it by order of the law.
Okay. On a slightly more political point, I mean, Scotland now has powers over income tax and other taxes as well, and for the first time since the devolution settlement in 1999, the bite of the capacity to sustain the tax base in relation to Scotland's public spending total will be felt by Scottish Government. When you're contemplating the policy platform running up to 2020, do you imagine offering the possibility of a lower tax alternative? I mean, Conservatives traditionally have used competition, lower tax policies as a way of winning votes. Do you find that possibility attractive?
I think rather than using it as a way of winning votes, we've used it as a way of making sure we had a dynamic economy that encouraged inward investment, created jobs and opportunities. I think that's what you meant to say, Tony.
How right you were to notice. That's what I really meant. But I thought, being a politician, I might go for the political question. Heaven forfend we should think it would be a political motive.
I mean, I think, you know, I've sometimes referred to the Scottish Parliament as either a fledgling parliament or an adolescent parliament, and I think with the advent of certain tax powers coming, it's growing up a little bit. And I don't think from a unionist perspective you can overstate how helpful it's been to the nationalist cause to have a nationalist government that's been able to go around the country, and all governments have a bigger microphone than opposition and all the rest of it, and say that everything good in Scotland is because the SNP government spent money on it, and everything bad is because those bastards at Westminster wouldn't give them enough. You know, the amount of grievance they've been able to make from that, the amount of headway and promotion that they've been able to do about that, you know, has been phenomenal, and they've been good at exploiting it. You know, I'm not taking away their professionalism as grievance hunters. But I think that idea that you have a government in Holyrood that has to think about where money comes from as well as where it goes to is a much more grown-up sense of politics. And I think it was always slightly ludicrous that you had a system wherein every year a packet of money came up the A1 from London to Edinburgh, and then you had people that were elected and paid to talk about how you hand that money out, you know, and there was no idea of the other side of the balance sheet. And you're right, there's a huge opportunity here for Scotland, I think, in terms of if Scotland becomes more dynamic, if Scotland encourages more inward investment, if we grow our economy, if we increase the number of jobs, if we manage to get more people into higher rates of taxation, move people up the income scales, have value-add jobs, we will have more money as a Scottish government to spend on public services and improving, you know, schools and hospitals and colleges and universities and all the rest of it. However, if we do the alternate, and if we scare away investment, and I think that we've had a very unfortunate budget in Scotland, an SNP-backed by Greens budget, which will make Scotland the highest taxed part of the UK for personal taxation. It will also part of the budget saw the large business supplement element of business taxation, of business rates, doubled overnight without any consultation with business. We've also seen a wholesale change to stamp duty for houses, change which has slowed down the housing market because people are being hit harder. You've suddenly got the point where it is now more expensive to live, to work, to start a business, to grow a business, as well as the geography of Scotland of being further away from some of your main markets. So I think there's a real issue that we're going to see in coming years, where we already have a slower economy than the rest of the UK. We already have a higher rate of unemployment. We already have a lower rate of employment. You know, and we're about to see these policies writ large. So as a really short answer to saying that the Scottish elections in 2021, not 2020, as I'm bringing my manifesto to bear for that, we'll be looking very closely at taxation.
So that's a possibility, then, that you'd certainly think about, sort of, would you reverse tax increases?
Our very, very baseline, absolute baseline, is you should not be taxed more for living in Scotland than elsewhere of the UK. You should not hang a sign at Gretna that says higher taxes here. That's the very base. And if we can make the economics work and find the money to be able to start reducing taxation elsewhere, then that's something that we will look seriously at.
Okay, very clear. Right, now, questions, comments? Right, we've got one here and then one there, as I saw them, one over there. So, yep, here, two, three. You're on.
Maggie Ellis, I'm probably one of the few people in the room, or even at LSE, who commutes between half a mile from here and 650 miles northwest. I call in quite frequently at Holyrood to attend a couple of cross-party groups. I have a couple of points quickly to make. One is, my neighbours on the northwest coast of Scotland feel rather like people in the middle of the country in England who feel that Westminster has no idea about what they're doing. I'm afraid my neighbours in the north feel that nobody in Holyrood understands, and I mean nobody. And I think that has to be addressed. If there's any sense of a union to be held, because there's no feeling in my village of any union at all. On the other hand, when I go, as I do to Brussels, to meetings about technology and health, I am delighted to see 10 senior officials from Scotland in the ROM, 4 from Wales, 4 from Northern Ireland. I'm probably the most senior person in the room from anyone in England. And that horrifies me. So I think on both counts, one has to worry about how we're represented, whether it's in England via Brussels or the west coast of Scotland via Holyrood. Your advice, please.
Okay, very good. Shall we take another
sorry.
Couple?
There's
a couple up, get more in. So, Chuck here and then over there.
I'm Nick Hoyle. When Theresa May went into Downing Street for the first time, she said that Brexit meant Brexit, but she also talked about the importance of the union to her as well. Hmm. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your working relationship with her, and in particular, your political advice to her on how she should position Scotland within the Brexit discussions.
Very good. And over there.
As a keen watcher of politics in the United Kingdom, I've seen Labour and Tory governments come and go. But it seems over the last 10 years or so, the SNP has really been the only game in town, no offence, in Scotland. And I just wonder if you could shed some light on the SNP's phenomenal success and perhaps when you think they might finally come unstuck.
Okay, that's three things there. Maggie, I find it unusual that you say nobody in the northwest of Scotland has any idea or sense of self in terms of the United Kingdom, because it voted so strongly to stay part of the UK just in 2014. I do think that particularly in rural Scotland, there is an issue of feeling that politicians generally don't understand
Did you say that life? Holyrood didn't understand, though, Maggie? I think you said that Holyrood didn't understand in the northwest. Is that what you said?
I said Holyrood.
But is it that Holyrood doesn't understand, or the UK government doesn't understand the northwest? Okay.
I mean, this understanding up and down. And
okay.
I think it really has got to be a central issue for all government.
Yeah, okay. And I think actually, in a sense, it's not just the UK where there feels like a disconnect from citizens, particularly at geographic fringes. You quite often see, as you look across Europe and other Western industrialised nations, a big disparity in votes between urban metropolitan areas and rural areas. I think a lot of policy in Scotland of centralisation has not helped in the last decade or so. 8 police forces folding into a single force, all of the colleges amalgamating 3 or 4 at a time. I also don't think that it is coincidental that the highest voting Remain votes, as in the highest voting people that voted to stay within the UK in 2014, no votes, were furthest away from Edinburgh, furthest away from the Central Belt. Because people there feel at least as distant from Holyrood as they do from the UK. So while that's not to excuse myself or my compatriots in either Holyrood or Westminster, it is to recognise that particularly where it comes to rural communities, the sense of isolation and political isolation is acute. And that's not their fault, that's ours, and it's incumbent upon us to try and build the bridge and to make sure that there is greater interaction and greater ownership from people in geographic and rural fringes. Nick, in terms of my relationship with Theresa May and her commitment to the union, I know Theresa May better than I knew David Cameron when I started in this job because of her role in the Home Office. That's kind of half devolved, half reserved. So she did quite a lot of anti-terror stuff in Scotland, although all the policing stuff was England only, etc. So I've known her for some time. I find her a fascinating study, actually. In real life, she is a bit different from her media persona. She's got a wicked sense of humour. She's very self-deprecating. I'm not sure that necessarily comes across. She's quite pithy sometimes. I like her immensely. I also, in terms of her way of going about things, I know that there can be a lot of frustration, particularly within people in my old profession of journalism, that she has this old-fashioned idea of taking lots of information and then making a decision and then sticking to it, rather than reacting to 24-hour news the minute something breaks on Sky. We're not wrong for long. And you know, I think what was really stark was you could sense after she became Prime Minister in the summer that everybody, particularly the broadcasters, had thought there was going to be a 100-day plan, there was going to be a photo op a day, there was going to be like all that sort of stuff, and there just wasn't. You know, when she has something that she wants to come out and say, she will come out and say it, and it will be considered, and she will have met with several interest groups and experts and all the rest of it before she says it. And then when it's said, she'll go away again and work on all of the other things that you've got to do as the leader of a G7 nation. I think as well, in terms of her commitment to the United Kingdom, it's absolute and it's from a very genuine place. It's not just a case of, oh shit, I might be the PM that's lost us the union. You know, it's actually, you know, this is, she's got a sense of country, she's got a sense of self. A lot's been written about her as being, you know, the vicar's daughter from the background that she's from and all the rest of it. But I think that misunderstands her sense of British identity, not just English identity. And these things are different. I think in terms of her ability to do small talk, I'm not sure she's quite as hail fellow well met as some people are, because she's grappling with some quite big questions. I mean, she's about to do something that has never been done before, and she's about to start it after less than a year in the job. And although we sometimes take a view of ourselves that is different to others' views of us in the United Kingdom, let's not forget that we are still a G7 nation. We're in the P5 at the UN. You know, we're one of the, we might be a small island, but we're one of the really big countries in the world. The approach that the leader of a big country takes matters. The sense that she's got to steer the ship while also doing this enormous Brexit thing weighs very heavily on her, and she takes that responsibility seriously. And I think that what I've been heartened by has been her sense, and you know, I would have her repeat this every day if I could, her sense that this is not about pulling up a drawbridge. This is about us making sure that we have a new free trade agreement with the EU, that we still take our responsibilities in the world seriously. That's as a military power, that's as a soft power, that's as a mercantile and trading nation, that's as all of these other things. And I think particularly when you see some of the economic nationalism and popular nationalism that's going on around the world in other G7 nations right now, and the rise of Trumpism, of Syriza, Podemos, and all the Five Star, all of these other things, I don't think that we can restate that enough. There is a gap in the world right now for a country that will stand up and say, do you know what, free trade is good. Making sure that we have global multinational cooperation is good. Making sure that we have a forum like the UN and that we shoulder our responsibility in the world, that is good. Making sure that we put aside a set amount of our income to help those because we've got broader shoulders than they have, and to solve problems or to aid problems in other parts of the world rather than exporting those problems to us, that is good and it is moral. And we shouldn't be afraid of using some of these words that have that sort of loaded political term like moral and good. And, you know, she's in the first year of the role, but frankly, I want to see a bit more of what she's already done, because I think she's got a really solid head on her shoulders, and I want to see more of it. Sorry, I went off on one there. Okay. Third question.
SNP, only game in town, why successful?
Ah, yes. You are very young, sir. Well done, you. Because if you had listened to the introduction from Tony, you will have heard that way, way back in the 1950s, the political hegemony in Scotland was the Conservative Party. When it got, it's the only time beyond 2015 that a political party has had more than 50% of the popular votes in Scotland. Before that, the Liberals were the preeminent political culture in Scotland until their wipeout in 1948. We then had the Labour Party years, where they controlled almost every single council, never mind were in government in Westminster and holding the major role in the coalition of government at Holyrood for several terms. So, you know, it's not that I'm just saying it's the SNP's turn. They've done very well. They've built a formidable political machine. They've reacted well to events. They are a very good campaigning organisation. They have a clarity of thinking. In that it doesn't matter what happens, the answer is always nationalism. Doesn't matter what the question is. It makes it easy to write the press releases. That's all I'm saying. But, you know, we have already seen from the high watermark of 2015, where they got over 50% of the vote, that then came down to 46% of the vote, and they lost their majority in Parliament in May of last year. We've got the local government elections coming up in May of this year. I would expect to see the percentage share go down again. And, we'll, you know, there's lots of miles to play out in the politics of Scotland, but I do not expect to see, nor do I know anybody that's an active combatant in Scottish politics that expects to see the SNP at the zenith forever. And my own view is that as devilishly talented as my team are at Holyrood, it won't necessarily be us that brings them down, nor will it be the Labour Party that brings them down. I believe it will be hubris that brings down the SNP in the way that an awful lot of governments are brought down by the very same. And if I was a betting woman... Actually, I am a betting woman, but you can't get odds for that at Paddy Power, so there's no need. Anyway.
Very good. OK, more questions. And if anybody... Yes, I don't want to forget you up there. So let's take a chap at the back, otherwise it really will look discriminatory against people in the balcony. And then hand at the back and the man at the front. I'll come back to something.
Andrew Smith, I just wondered, we keep getting told we have to get behind the 51.9% that voted for Brexit. If the majority had just been one person, would we have to get behind the one person, even if we think it's a foolish, crazy, idiotic thing?
Okay. I think then at the back there, yep.
Hi. It strikes me that with a number of the... issues that you just flagged as being moral or good.
Oh, sorry, I was back up in the balcony there. No, I've got you. Yeah.
That actually there's a lot of voices in your party who aren't currently representing those things, who oppose foreign aid, who are taking a pretty protectionist approach to Brexit, who are, you know, pulling up the drawbridge to refugees. I mean, do you ever wake up and wonder why you're a Tory?
Clear question. And the gentleman at the front here. Can we get a microphone round at the front? Oh, yes.
After the Scottish referendum, the Labour Party was criticised for working with the Tories. A lot of its members were very critical. During the European referendum, there seemed a lot of the time as if the Labour Party was absent. Will Straw had difficulty even getting an audience with Jeremy Corbyn. What is the Labour Party going to do if there's another Scottish referendum? Are they going to be a strong voice for the Union, or are they going to be divided? What is their attitude to the Union now?
Okay.
So that's three nice political ones, including allowing you to talk about the Labour Party.
I'll start at the end and work my way back, if that's all right. I mean, I have many responsibilities and many political experiences and gifts. One of them is not divining what the hell the Corbyn Labour Party is going to do next, sir. I'm sorry. I would expect that the Labour Party would campaign to stay part of the United Kingdom in Scotland. All of the indicators are that it will continue to do so, mostly because the people have left them that left them at 2014 have stayed with the SNP, so the people who are their membership are pro-UK. One of the reasons we profited so largely in the Scottish election of last year, more than doubling our number of votes, more than doubling our number of seats, overtaking the Labour Party for the first time, pushing them into third for the first time in more than 60 years, which is a pretty big cultural shift in Scotland, was because we were better able to articulate that pro-union message. And the people who had stayed with them up until that point thought that we were a better bet to be able to execute their desire, which was a strong voice for the United Kingdom, a strong voice to stand up against the SNP. So I would expect them to stay there. To the lady's question there, I'm a Conservative because I believe in what I've always believed, and that's in personal choice, in personal freedom, in personal responsibility. I believe that the pound in your pocket is better spent by the person that earned it rather than a nameless, faceless bureaucratic state that tells you what that money should be spent on. And in terms of my colleagues who opine against foreign aid, then they're just wrong. I am long of the opinion that, and have written extensively actually, luckily the Telegraph UK often give me a space to opine about things that other Tories don't tend to write about. The issue about foreign aid is, I think, an issue about who you are. It's also about what your responsibility is, not just to your own people, but also to the world. In the United Kingdom, we have always believed that one of the roles of government is to keep the populace of the United Kingdom safe, but it is also to demonstrate values which help keep the world safe, and then, by extension, help keep the United Kingdom safe. My own background is actually not in aid at all. It was in journalism, but I think one of the most formative experiences I ever had was as a very young journalist going out to Kosovo just at the tail end of the war. I mean, I was like in my very, very early 20s, and seeing it firsthand the force for good the UK can be in the world. Watching lads of 18, 19 that went to my school and were the sort of kids that the teachers didn't give a second chance to, keeping people safe, stopping children from being shot, coming in after patrols, putting down their weapons, having a quick brew and heading back out again when they could have been phoning their wives, they could have been phoning their girlfriends, they could have been writing to their mum, and in their own free time helping to build an orphanage. We make a difference. We don't give ourselves anywhere near enough credit for the difference that we can make in the world. You can argue over the 0.7%.
Do you believe in liberal interventionism? I mean, do you actually believe the British state, in addition to aid, should be involved more in intervening to stop seriously bad things happening?
I think that it's very difficult to write a doctrine that fits the world when every conflict is different. And I think that Tony Blair tried really hard, particularly with the Stockholm Convention, about this idea that you can intervene within the boundaries of a sovereign state in order to stop a genocide or whatever. And you saw in Kosovo, without the West being invited in, you saw in Sierra Leone, you saw that work. You have seen in Iraq it not work. You know, there are. I find it hard to be doctrinaire about that. Do I think that there are cases wherein there is an absolute imperative for others to act to save? Yes, I do. And I think that I remember at the time of the Syria vote, I was on Question Time and I was asked. It was like 2 days after the vote or something, and I was asked about it, and it was one of the questions that came up. And I refused to condemn the Labour MPs that had changed their vote under Ed Miliband, because at the time I thought that the choice was an awful choice. The choice was you either vote to intervene in Syria and people will die, or you vote not to intervene in Syria and people will die. And that is the choice that you have. And that is one of the things that we ask of our parliamentarians. And it's a hellish day to go to work. It's a hellish day. And I've never been so happy I didn't sit in the House of Commons as that day. And we have only seen since that while action has a cost, not acting has a cost too. And that cost must also be counted when you make a decision. So sorry to kind of get a bit heavy on you, you know, I strongly believe in aid, and like I say, you can quibble over the 0.7%, you can quibble over the 2% in case of military spend, but honestly, that is one of the things I'm most proudest of as a Conservative, that we brought in that 0.7%. It's one of the things that makes me most proud. And when I see organisations like the Halo Trust that have just made Mozambique mine-free, that have got a plan that they, with a bit of help, and I keep bashing my colleagues over the head to put their hand in their pocket and give them a bit more, because they and the Mines Advisory Group, two British charities, two British NGOs, do 80% of mine clearance work the world over. You know, we are at the cusp right now of our generation's smallpox moment. We could eradicate mines. We could take away that from every country in the world. They think by 2025 they could make the world mine-free. Now, these are things that we have stopped using as a military. We've stopped making. We signed an accord 20 years ago, if you all remember Princess Diana out there in Angola, all the rest of it. You know, there's still mines in Kosovo. There's still kids getting their legs blown off in Nicaragua. These are, the conflict has moved on, and you've got large tracts of land where people cannot go. You've got farmland that people cannot farm. Getting rid of something like that means that you stop. You can hire local populace, so people that are otherwise in exactly the right target area to be recruited into extreme or pan-military organisations. So these are, you know, stops jihadis being recruited by ISIS or whatever. You know, there is so much universal good that you can do that aids out from that. You can stop having to spend more money to help support food production in a country or aid production if you can return farmland, if you can have a rule of law, if you can have people in work, if you can have less terror within the confines of a state. This is something that is just a web that grows out of it. So, you know, I absolutely believe in this, and it may be unfashionable in the Tory party. Actually, I don't think it is when you've got people like Johnny Mercer and Tom Tugendhat and lots of these new MPs that have come in that have got real sense of this around the world. I'm often asked if I want to come to Westminster. Actually, I have never really lusted after it, but the one job that I would love would be to be International Development Secretary, because I think you can do the most good for the most people. We are the second biggest giver of aid in the world outside the United States, and God knows how long the United States will keep giving. You know, we change lives. We save lives. We should not be ashamed of that. We should be proud of it. We are the biggest educator of girls anywhere in the world. Anywhere. We get more young women to school as part of one of the flagship DFID projects than any other NGO, any other country, any other organisation. 20 million girls are in school or have gone through school because of 0.7% of the money that you hand over in your tax at the end of the month. I think that's a good thing. And it's not just about teaching girls. It's about building communities. It's about sense of self, sense of place. It's about stopping female genital mutilation. It's about stopping child brides. It's about having women having microeconomies within their own villages. The way you build a country is by building its people. We're doing this. Do you know, we never fucking talk about it. I don't know why, but we're doing it, and it's really, really good, and we should do more of it. Anyway, sorry, I'm off the beaten track now, sorry.
The gentleman at the back who said a majority of one. I mean, which I think yes. The question was, are we sort of, is the parliament, is the political system buckling to the 50.8, 50.9% rather than representing the 48.2?
I'll be really quick on this one. I know everyone's leaving now. I'm sorry about that. You're all missing trains. Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I've probably had enough of referendums for my lifetime. They're binary by nature. They're divisive by nature. They set people against each other. They make incredibly complex issues into black and white, and no issue is black and white. And it breeds the sort of resentment that questioner asks. You know, why should I get behind something that only X hundred thousand more people wanted than the polar opposite, which is what I wanted. How do you bring a country back together after that? I think we said that we would ask the country and we would abide by what the country said and we would make it happen, and so we will, and that is what, you know, so to do. I don't think anyone thinks we're not going to leave the European Union. But I do think that we have enough politicians in this country. Let's get back to representative democracy. I've had enough of direct democracy. I'm done. I'm done. Stick a fork in me. I'm done.
Okay. Right. Now, man there. And then right on the left here. And then anybody in particular, but an arm in the middle over there. Yep.
It's a war of attrition. Yep. He's just going to keep taking hands until everybody leaves. So the last person sitting in your seat, you get to win a prize.
Right.
I'm often greatly saddened and annoyed when I see SNP members of Westminster treating it as a joke, laughing and
singing.
Singing. I think it's. I mean, are they the joke or not? But my proper question is. Is pro-President Trump likely to be a helpful friend or hindrance to Scotland and the Union?
Very good.
I thought I'd better add some humour.
Woman, lady at the back somewhere, I think.
Hi, it's linked to the question that the person upstairs asked. Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you were saying that if you had been sitting in Westminster, you would have voted to trigger Article 50, and it's more around the nature of representation. So if the people who represent you to be there haven't voted for it, but the country at large are, where does that leave you? Who are you representing in that situation?
It is a tangle, this representative versus delegate democracy issue. And gentlemen there.
Yes, Gary Toft. I always make it a policy whenever I meet a veteran to say thank you for your service. So thank you for your service. My question is, I like what you said about the economy, about education. The fact of the matter is, you can't govern if you don't win. And if you really want to stop the S&P, there's one surefire way to do that, and that's for you to win the next election.
I'm on it. On it.
Well, congratulations on doubling the Tories' number of seats in the last election, but you need to do it again. So what is the plan to get to 65 seats? And I think the Tories are now sitting at something like 27% in the polls. The number of people who oppose having another referendum are at least twice that. So the Tories have room to grow. What is your plan to attract some of those soft nationalists? Some of those people are open to a message of a strong Scotland, within the United Kingdom, but maybe have parked their votes with the S&P for now, but are open to being persuaded.
Okay. In terms of the SNP at Westminster being a joke, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I don't think that's a fair characterisation. I think there are a number who are very assiduous parliamentary attenders, parliamentary speakers, take part in debates, lay questions, are very involved in their committees. I think the fundamental difference is they don't want to be a part of that because they don't want their roles to exist. You know, and I think that does put you in a different mindset about how you go about your business. I do think that there is, within the SNP, a kind of culture of slightly snubbing your nose at some form of British traditions, particularly ones that they don't see the point of. So they don't see the point of not clapping, or just like tapping your paper or braying, you know, so they're not hugely respectful of that, in a sense. But I'm not sure it is fair to say that every SNP MP treats their job as a joke, because actually I don't think they do. In terms of Trump, in terms of is he a hindrance or a help to Scotland? Well, as you know, when JFK was elected president, there was almost a fiesta in Ireland because they had a part Irish president. We've almost cleared up the ticker tape from November. No, we haven't. Trump has an odd association with Scotland. He has a number of businesses there. He has a couple of golf courses there. He parks his private jet at the Scottish Government-owned Prestwick Airport every time he comes. He used to be very, very good friends with Alex Salmond. They used to hang out quite a bit. They then had a massive falling out and they hate each other now, and they both talk about, in private and in public, about how much they hate each other. It's really odd, odd situation. I quite like and respect Parliament. However, I have a small, puckish sense of humour. And when Donald Trump, a number of years ago, was called before one of our parliamentary committees to speak to the Economy Committee regarding wind farms, of all things, because he was objecting to an offshore wind farm that would have spoilt the view from one of his golf courses, he arrived with a large sort of entourage, and there was quite a lot of cameras and everything as he came to give evidence to this committee. And some very resourceful Scottish people decided that the best way to welcome him to Parliament was to bring some balloons with them, which they rubbed on the thighs of their trousers and then held above his head. So there's quite a lot of pictures online of his hair just going like this. Now, I believe in respecting everybody that takes time out of their day to come and give evidence to parliamentary committees. However, there was a little bit of me that giggled. Just a little bit. That I maybe have to answer to that on Judgment Day. But Trump doesn't believe in Scottish independence, but I'm not sure I would put him on a poster to help us if there was ever another fight to save the union. Is that that's a long way of saying that. In terms of the gentleman over here, yeah, you're right. We have a long way to go to become the government of Scotland. However, to give people context in the room, I have more MSPs now than the SNP did in the term before they became the government. So it's doable. Part of my job, nobody would have thought, right up until polling day itself in May of last year, nobody was predicting that we would overtake the Labour Party, that we would open up Clear Blue Water, that we would become the official opposition. I had to work incredibly hard as the leader of a third party in Scotland that for 20 years had been a moribund, almost a joke, you know, was accused of resuscitating a corpse and all the rest of it, to get us to the position where we could be seen as a viable official opposition in Parliament. Now, some of that was about proper graft, some of that was about recruiting good people, some of that was about all of the things that you have to do in a campaign. Some of it was, frankly, just doing anything I could so people would even notice us, like getting on the back of a tank or a buffalo or any of the other things that I had to do. And we got us to that position. My job over the next 5 years is to start laying the groundwork so that I'm seen as an alternative First Minister of Scotland and that my party is seen as an alternative government of Scotland. Now, we are not there yet. We are a long way from there. But I have 5 years to make that happen, and just as I had a very clear plan in my head of how I would get us to where we are now, I've got a very clear plan in my head, and I've now managed to recruit the team behind me, and we've pound for pound, man for man, I would put my parliamentary group up against any in Holyrood and think that we've got higher quality people with greater experience, more ability. You know, I would absolutely put us up there, and I've got a job to do over the next 5 years to make us look and sound not just like a good opposition, but like an alternative government, and that's exactly what I'm going to do.
Take a question. We're going to got about another 10 minutes or so. Question right at the, yes, right at the edge there and behind, and then, yes, I better take one more from the balcony. And then I'll come back to you. So we'll keep these quickly now. Let's move them. Yep, you're on.
I don't think the length of the questions is a problem. I think it's me. I think I'm talking a lot, Tony.
That's why you're here.
All right, OK, that's fine then.
We like that. Go on, question at the back.
Following the two referendum results from Scottish independence and the EU ref, why do you think it is that for Scots the EU is much more popular to remain in than the UK?
So why do you think, yeah, okay, very good. And then there was another question at the back there.
Do you think that Theresa May is criticising Trump harshly enough, or is she being too careful and eager to please?
Best of luck. Yeah. Especially, we've saved that one for the end.
Thanks for the hospital pass, mate.
And
cheers.
Then up at the top here, yep.
Thank you. As a Scot who's now spent half my life in England on the wrong side of the border, to what extent do you think the quest for independence is about anti-Englishness as opposed to national independence. And in that, I'm thinking about the desire to become part of a league of small, powerful nations rather than playing second fiddle to a historic, in a sense, world power that England or Britain would be still viewed as.
Yeah, in terms of the last question, I think there is... we all know in Scotland when the SNP use the word Westminster, what they really mean is England or English. That's their cipher. I think while I can't see into the inner thoughts of SNP politicians, so I don't know how much of it is wanting to be is just wanting to be a separate, or how much of it is about defining yourself against something else. I do think that as an organisation and as a group, one of their tactics, their electoral tactics, has been to try and promote this idea of Scottish exceptionalism, so that Scotland is different to, and brackets, therefore better than. And in a weird way, we've actually got to a system in Scotland where the contortions are such that even all nationalisms are bad apart from Scottish nationalisms, which are civic and good. It does take some doing. And I think a lot of it flies in the face of some of the evidence as well. So every year you have the sort of gold standard of attitudinal surveys called the Scottish Attitude Survey, and I think in England it's just called the Attitude Survey. And it asks people about their relationship with what do they think about immigration, about gay marriage, about pension spend, all of these different sort of social areas of social policy. And the idea that Scotland is wildly different from England is nonsense. It really is. I mean, it's margin of error stuff. And why would it be? Because if you grow up in Glasgow, then is your upbringing really that different from growing up in Liverpool or Belfast or, you know, any other big post-industrial city? I don't think it is. So I think that it is very easy when trying to set up what you would be to set yourself against what already is. So there's that idea, if I was to try and delve back into my incredibly useless English literature degree that I've never used from when I was sort of 20, I would say it was probably something to do with Derrida's theory of the other and setting Scotland up in opposition to the other, and the other in this case being England, and England being bigger and in some way an oppressor figure, despite the fact that the union that we exist in, Scots help build, we have ownership of, and all the rest of it. So I'm not sure if I can give you a percentage of how much of it is anti-English, but I think it would be naive to suggest that there's not a scrap of it in there. In terms of the EU, why is it more popular than the UK? I don't accept the premise of your question. I particularly don't accept it when you saw the turnout being so completely different. You know, it was 85% turnout at the Scottish independence referendum. You know, it was... you know, way, way, way below that at the EU one. Also, there was an awful lot of independence questions that were going on within the EU one. So, you know, all of the unionist parties or pro-union parties were telling their people, you know, vote to remain because the SNP have said that they're going to try and reheat independence if there's a leave vote. The SNP... are, you know, born-again European lovers, even though that wasn't the way that they have always been in their history. Independence in Europe only came in a couple of decades ago as their primary sort of source. So they were saying, if you believe in independence, vote to remain. So there was actually quite a lot of things that were going on behind the surface there. And saving my favourite to last, is Theresa May criticising Trump enough? Is she not criticising him too much? What should she do in relation to him? I actually don't care what Theresa May, the person, how she interacts with Donald Trump, the person. What I care about is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom having a relationship with the President of the United States that is to the benefit of the people of the United Kingdom and to the benefit of the organisations in which we are both members. I think what was really quite telling out of her visit was she stood up at the podium and said that he was fully behind the EU and that he was going to, he was fully behind NATO and he was going to keep up the American contribution to NATO. And he didn't contradict her, and he agreed. Actually, that's something that our European partners have wanted some form of response from for some time, and she managed to get him there. And actually, I thought that was quite a telling moment as part of that visit. So I have heard from some of the people that were on the visit, some of the chat that happened behind the scenes that went on in the state visit, which sounds interesting, and I'm sure it will feature in a number of people's memoirs.
We don't want to give us just a
not a chance,
sense.
Not a bloody chance. But I think it was. I don't think people knew what to expect, and it didn't disappoint. Am I okay? Am I in trouble? Have I just committed news? Am I okay? Right, okay. In terms of. Personally, I don't care how they get on. What I care about is that we as the United Kingdom have a relationship with the United States. That goes, yes, that happens at leadership level, but it happens at so many other levels too. It happens at a trade level, it happens at a diplomatic level, it happens at a military level, it happens in so many different ways. And, I don't think that it's going to be easy for the next 4 years, but I think that we need people that are willing to put their shoulder to the wheel. So... that's how I got out of that one.
Very good. Now, we've got... I'll take one more round of questions, especially if there's some issue we haven't touched on at all so far. Everybody's in that position. That's unhelpful, isn't it? Right. So, red... yes, you deserve it for waving a red document. That's good. Then a chap here.
Thank you very much, Ross Murray. I get the sense that the term Tory has become highly pejorative, far more so than when I was... brought up in the Highlands. And I just wonder whether you're tempted at the next election to actually concentrate more on fighting for the union than you are for conservatism. And do you find suggestions from within the party helpful that you adjust the name of your party?
Okay, very clear. And in the middle here, yep, it's you. No, here, actually. Sorry, it's my fault. All right, you then here.
I must say, your smile about 2 minutes ago is the most intriguing part of the very enlivening hour or so. Going back to Scotland, you touched very lightly on the centralisation of the government policy. I'm actually from Wales, where there's been very little structural reform at all. I was wondering, as a leader of the opposition, or indeed as a Conservative, what's the specific criticisms of the government centralisation policies might be?
And you can attack the Welsh government as well at the same time. Double win there. And here.
Matthew Fan. I feel like Donald Trump doesn't understand how free trade deals can be mutually beneficial. So I feel like every decision has to have a winner and a loser. So with this in mind... do you think that a US-UK trade deal will actually benefit the UK?
Very good. And last but not least.
So I voted to remain in the UK in 2014, and I voted to stay in the EU, down the front, in 2016.
Yeah.
So how can you convince me as a proud European from Scotland with a long history, way beyond trade, of cultural intermingling between these countries, why would I want to stay in the UK that is convinced that it wants to leave, and whatever type of UK comes out of that, whether it's a nice outward-looking global trading nation or whether it's a small, narrow-minded tax haven where we have our GPs as border patrol, you know, what is it about the UK that should attract me, whereas there's an entire continent of wonderful ideas and cultural shared cultural values that we seem to be, trotting away from.
Okay. Well, I think, again, to start at the end, the way in which you've structured your question is set upon the idea that Scots will have to pick one union or the other. That's not the question. The question is, do you choose to leave one union or do you choose to leave two? Because there is no suggestion that Scotland is going to be the continuation state of the EU. You've already had senior SNP members pulling back from the idea that they would even go for EU membership, and they've seriously floated the idea of just EFTA. So if your argument is that you enjoy and thrive on and, like me, value the idea of internationalism, of working with others, and all the rest of it, if you're attracted to wider unions, there's a reason why I fought on the side of both of them, is because while I don't see the UK and the EU as facsimiles of each other, I do see enough within them that I do not understand, and as I said it in there, I don't understand this idea that if you stub your toe and the UK says it's going to leave the EU, which was not my choice, why my response to that is to say, well, actually, then I want to leave the UK as well. You know, I want to be completely alone. I don't want to be with my three pals. I want to be completely on my own in a corner somewhere. And so I don't see how the answer to one is the other. And I also think that the relationship that we had or have currently until we leave with the other EU27 member states is a looser relationship than we have with Wales and Northern Ireland and the UK. So it's not just about sharing a currency and a central bank and, you know, all of these sort of organisations and charities and all the rest of it that exists in a pan-UK way. It's also about sharing a history. It's about sharing a mindset, a people, a desire, a, you know, all of these other things that go along with it that are very difficult to articulate. And I think as well, one of the reasons that the strength of feeling in Scotland was quite surprising, particularly for no voters who were quite quiet during the first independence referendum, they felt quite intimidated by some of the louder, brasher marching, the flags, the cybernattery being shouted down on social media and all the other things that went along with the yes side. But there was a kind of real determination, and I think one of the reasons that you haven't seen very much leakage from no to yes is that it sort of surprised people. It certainly surprised me how much personal identity was wrapped up in the idea of national identity. I'd never really thought about myself before and where I stood and sat and all the rest of it, but I did feel like if Scotland went independent, as somebody who's never really thought about being Scottish and British, that the other people, this other, that were on the other side, were trying to take something away from me. They were taking the British bit of myself away and they weren't telling me what I was getting in return. And I've spoken to people kind of since then, and they were kind of surprised because, you know, you don't sit around in the pub, like, pondering yourself, your sense of self and your national identity or any of that sort of stuff. But the referendum in Scotland really did make us ask questions of ourselves, and we were quite often surprised by what those answers were. And I think that that's one of the reasons why the European referendum in Scotland felt like someone else's war, because we'd already had all of the questions that were going on down here, but we'd had them in a much closer to home way. We'd had them in a much more visceral way. And I think that's also probably one of the reasons why the turnout was so much lower for the European referendum in Scotland than it was for the independence referendum, because it touched us much more deeply. That may be an imperfect answer to the question that you asked, but it's trying to explain something that I'm not very articulate about, so I apologise for that. In terms of the US-UK trade deal, I honestly have no idea what Donald Trump's level of economic education is, whether he sees all deals as somebody must win and somebody must lose or not. So I can't really comment on that. What I can say is I cannot see a UK government signing a trade deal that would not be to our advantage. To our mutual advantage between the two sides, absolutely, but to our advantage too. Yes, if there is a trade deal going forward, I would expect us to benefit from that. As with, I believe, most deals which see the breaking down of tariffs, which see the ability to trade and to deal freely and all the rest of it, I do see them as mutually beneficial in many ways. Now, the gentleman that talks about structural reform in Wales, and to talk about structural reform in Scotland, I'm going to take a massive, massive body swerve past Welsh politics, because anybody that can get that excited about electrifying a railway is beyond me. Every time I go to a Welsh Party conference, it's the first thing that's out of anybody's mouth is that we're electrifying a railway, and it seems to have been going on for many, many years. So I'm going to put Wales to one side and talk about what I know, which is Scotland.
Centralisation.
Yeah, and you know, we've seen that in a lot of things that people felt that they had ownership of. So people in Fife felt that they had ownership of their police force, Fife Police. It was badged. They knew that the headquarters was in Glenrothes. They could see their local constable. They knew who their local inspector was and all the rest of it. They felt that they had ownership, if you lived in Kirkcaldy, of Adam Smith College. You felt if you lived in Dunfermline, which is, you know, maybe 15 miles away, but very, very distinct and different towns that are quite jealous of each other in many ways, that you had ownership of Lauder College, or Carnegie College, as it changed its name to. The idea that these were kind of amalgamated and other things were added in as well, suddenly you didn't know what it was anymore. The idea that you didn't have anybody that regularly spoke to your local paper about local policing because Fife Police ended up becoming Police Scotland, and now the only person that was allowed on the telly was the former chief constable of Glasgow, which is miles away again. You felt like you lost something. And I think as well, there is a sense within Scotland that you kind of don't know how to get a real person on the phone anymore, that kind of automation thing, and particularly with our emergency services, because they amalgamated all of the control rooms. So you can phone up and give a very good description of whose house is getting robbed and on which estate it is, and the person at the other end of the phone has no idea where that is because they're 400 miles away, not 20 miles away. So I think that there is a sense of that. And I think, as well, there have been a couple of unfortunate events that have hit particular communities of purpose as well as communities of place that have left people feeling isolated. So the government was going to build, a whole new computer system for the regulation of single farm payments, which ran £100 million over budget, doesn't work, and lots of people didn't get any of their payments for, you know, some of them for a year, which left them out of pocket. The average income for a farm in Scotland without payments is less than zero. It costs you money to farm in Scotland on average. So there were people that were facing bankruptcy, all the rest of it, and they felt like there was an Edinburgh government that didn't care about the rurality. So I think there has been a sense of feeling as if everything's being gathered up in Holyrood, and decisions are being taken away from real people, if you like.
And then the very last question was the name. Is the name
Yes,
the
Tories, and is that a pejorative? Well, what's really interesting, if you're incredibly sad and anarchy like me, is that the Conservatives in Scotland have never been the Tories. So we didn't grow out of the Tory tradition. We amalgamated in the 1960s with the Progressives and the Unionists, and became Conservatives. So we hadn't historically, in the same way as the Conservative Party in England, ever been called Tories, so we were the Progressives and the Liberal Unionists. I'm trying to reclaim Tory as a word because, as somebody that used to work in journalism, I know that in 40 point, Conservative is too big for a headline, but Tory always fits. So that's a fight I'm never going to win. It also, in shorthand, because it's alliterative with top, it doesn't matter the lowliest activist that's done something stupid, it's always a top Tory. So I'm reclaiming Tory by the hashtag Team Tory every time any of my teams go out and are campaigning anywhere or any of the rest of it. I'm probably pushing sand up a hill, but I'm going to do it anyway. There was a big question mark when I ran for the leadership. The then deputy leader, who also ran, wanted to abolish not just the name, but also divorce us from the UK party and have a sort of CDU-CSU arrangement like in Germany. And my argument then was, if you have the same people with the same sort of arguments and the same policies changing their own name, you just kind of look like you're ashamed of being a Tory. And I'm not ashamed of being a Tory. You know, this is the party that I belong to. I'm shaping, I believe, a policy manifesto for 20, you know, for the modern age, rather than looking back to our history to make us more relevant than we have been in 20 years in Scotland, to discuss the challenges we face now and that we're going to face in the future. And I think that folk aren't daft. And your question is, you know, do you change the name and keep the old banger of a car, or do you change the car? Well, I'm changing the engine, I'm changing the wheels, I'm changing the steering, I'm changing the personnel. You know, I'm doing the hard job, not doing the not, you know, slapping a coat of makeup on the top. So I'm changing the car.
Very good. Right, we must we've overrun slightly, for which I apologise. It's my fault. From the chair, I'd just like to say two words to conclude. Really, I mean, a number of issues have come up this evening to do with the UK, Scotland, Scotland within the UK, the UK's relationship with Scotland, what the word nationalist means, how we interpret that differently, very differently at different times. Actually, a very interesting issue that. I think the one thing that strikes me about the, I mean, you mentioned the cyber gnats and the independence campaign. I think buried in that campaign, rather like the Brexit campaign, was the beginnings of something which used to exist in American politics and we didn't have as much in UK politics, which was sort of a culture war, or the risk of something that looks like a culture war doesn't go away afterwards. And I think that that's a big issue for all parts of UK politics, you know, how we get on and have the debates we want to have about political issues without them devolving into barriers upon, across which argument cannot be had. We don't want that. Anyway, if I may say so. But what I really want to do is to thank Ruth Davidson for coming and answering so many questions so elegantly this evening and giving a fascinating view into her philosophy and her conservative and unionist Scottish Conservative and Unionist philosophy. So, ladies and gentlemen, Ruth Davidson.